Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Debbie Gunkies with the Petowitz Group, and welcome to WRMR, Revenue Marketer Radio. We meet about twice a month to talk to phenomenal revenue marketers, not just your run-of-the-mill marketer, because I really believe that if we can talk to these people who are living and breathing the revenue marketing journey and learn their tips and tricks, it's going to make us all much more successful as marketers. Today's topic is really all about revenue marketing to enterprise size accounts. And if you stop and think about the market that we live in today and the number of companies that are using marketing automation, probably somewhere between 6,000 to 6,500, the largest percentage of those companies are small companies. So what we really want to focus on today is how do you take the concept of revenue marketing, demand generation, the use of marketing automation, and really apply it in the enterprise account pursuit. I'm so happy to introduce our guest. It's Patty Foley-Reed, and Patty is with Iron Mountain. So let me give you a little bit of bio around Patty, and then we're going to get straight into the interview because she has so much to share with you today. So Patty is a results-oriented marketing professional with more than 20 years' experience, and she's done both traditional and she's also done online marketing. At Iron Mountain, Patty is currently the Director of Enterprise Marketing, and she's responsible for driving revenue directly tied to marketing activities through account-based marketing, or really going after those large named accounts. Patty is the definition of the revenue marketer. If I had a dictionary and if revenue marketer was in it, you would see Patty Foley-Reed and a picture of her right there. Now, Patty's colleagues describe her as a driving force. I would completely agree with that in her organization. And she absolutely leads with contagious passion. She's got the proven ability to influence change, connect strategy to execution, and to deliver results. And Patty just doesn't deliver results. She over-delivers results. I personally know that she's blowing her numbers out of the water already this year. And those numbers equate to revenue. How much revenue is her group actually driving for the organization? So she really focuses on revenue marketing integrated into a program portfolio, one of the most impressive things I've seen in a long time. And that program portfolio is designed to drive lead volume, increase lead-to-opportunity conversion rates, and raise the average order size. Prior to Iron Mountain, Patty has held various senior marketing roles at a number of software technology companies in the Boston area. She's a graduate of the University of Massachusetts and received a Master of Science in Communications Management from Simmons College in Boston. Patty, welcome to the show.
Hey, wow, thanks, Debbie. That's a big intro. Appreciate
that. You have a lot to live up to here, but I don't think it's going to be a problem for you at all, Patty. So, Patty and I recently met, and one of the things that we had talked about was specifically what she was doing to drive business through revenue marketing at Iron Mountain. So, you know, before we kind of get into that story and actually what you're doing, Patty, why don't you start by telling our audience a little bit about the revenue marketing journey for you and for Iron Mountain?
Yeah, so I'm currently at Iron Mountain. I've been there for 8 years and am now the Director of Enterprise Demand Generation. And this is a fairly new role at Iron Mountain where we're focusing very specifically to support our enterprise account executives who sell specifically to named accounts. So I just started this in the middle of last year, have a team now in place for this year, and it's really, you know, my job to grow our contribution from a marketing perspective for sales and to grow that for next year in the range of about 25%. So the goals for this year are really to hit the number and to, you know, build that foundation. So as you described, you know, for revenue marketing so that, you know, as my marketing group can really provide a repeatable, predictable, and sustainable place where they can count on revenue contribution. that's so, my Patty, job now.
You didn't get there overnight. Kind of, how did this journey start for you, and how did this journey start for Iron Mountain to the point that, you know, you're absolutely a self-described revenue marketer?
Yeah, I had to really think about that, because then you were going to ask me the question, and I had to really dig deep and figure out exactly what year I really took on the challenge to get marketing automation at Iron Mountain, because I was feeling the pain so intensely that I really, you know, went to battle on that particular initiative and, you know, tried to convince the company that how desperately we needed marketing automation. And I think it really started when I wanted to do a nurture newsletter, frankly, and I recognized the need and the value in doing personalization and knew that I had to, like, really create some dynamic content into these newsletters that was specifically relevant. And I recognized that, you know, trying to do that manually was just debilitating. So that, for me, so that was
yes,
back in 2007.
Okay.
That was 2007, and I would say that's where it all started from a marketing automation perspective and trying to figure out how to attach ourselves to revenue.
You know, Patty, it's so interesting to me. If you go out and if you listen to a lot of the software vendors, it's like, you know, you buy the software and, you know, magic happens. And we know that's not true. So when you reflect on that journey, you guys began in 2007. You know, would you say that for most larger organizations that it's really a multi-year journey?
Absolutely. You know, it took us a long time to get it implemented into the company, to get it off the ground, to set up processes around it. It definitely took many, many, many years. And, you know, it's amazing when I look back and see how far we've come. It's pretty impressive.
I think you guys are very impressive as well. Well, let's chat a little bit more specifically about named account marketing and kind of what you guys do. I know that when we were chatting last week before today's interview, you kind of referred to this as a program portfolio. What is that, and kind of what are the components that you've outlined?
Yeah, I describe the strategy that we have in place for named account, you know, as this program portfolio. And for me, the analogy is really it's like an investment portfolio. And, you know, in all my years in marketing, you know, I've decided that it's more of a math game than anything else. So the way that I approach it as a program portfolio, like an investment portfolio, is to, you know, work the numbers. And I think the key in that is, you know, understanding what the objectives are and really the time frame that you need to deliver the leads or create the demand, and understand, you know, how much money do you really have to invest in those programs? You know, what's your tolerance for risk? What's the time frame that needs to be delivered? And it all works back to these numbers. You've got to figure out how to make the numbers work. So that's why I've approached it as a program portfolio. And I have some programs that drive greater volume that don't necessarily convert as well as other programs. Then I, you know, specifically design programs that I know will have high conversion rates. And then on the other end is really programs, I would say they're more one-to-few or one-to-one programs that, you know, there's not a lot of volume there. The conversion, you know, is a little risky, but the payoff and the average order size is high. So I try to make sure, you know, I put all my eggs in those different baskets so that, again, it's like working the numbers to make sure that, you know, it all pays off in the end, given the investment that we have.
So, Patty, I know that this is you had a prior role in the company, and you're coming in, and this year is really a foundation year for you guys, just to prove that you can hit the numbers, and you are. When you began putting this program portfolio together, did you put it in three buckets, saying I've got some programs that are going to be greater volume, some programs that are going to give me high conversion rates, and some programs that are going to be one-to-one, one-to-few, but they'll give me a big payoff? Did you consciously think that and structure it, or did it kind of grow out of trying and seeing what was successful?
No, it definitely came out of the math equation that said, you know, years ago, because we couldn't really understand the lead waterfall and have insight into, you know, why things were getting stuck or why things weren't moving through, you know, now that we have better visibility into that, you know, we have better control. So when I really work the numbers and look at the math, I say, you know, what's the revenue I have to generate? What's the investment that I've been giving to get to that number? And then how, like, what kind of lead volume is required for that? At what rate do they have to convert? And at what average order size? So those are the three components that, you know, pretty much fall out of the math equation that says it's the volume, it's the conversion that they, or it's the rate that they convert from leads to opportunities, and then it's those deal sizes, you know, that have to be relatively big in order for me to make any hay with the money that I have. And when you look at it that way, you know, you can easily go back and have a conversation with management to say, listen, you know, if our average order size is in the $1,000 range or the $10,000 range, you know, the numbers just won't work unless you have incredibly insane conversion or that your volume is, you know, out of the roof. But then, you know, that volume, it's like, all right, you map it back to the math that says what's the average order or what's the cost per lead. And, you know, I don't have that money to spend. So you've got to, that's where it's not just volume. You got to get the conversion to work and you got to adjust or go after the, you know, a very specific average order size.
So let me
ask you,
this brings up, yeah, oh, absolutely. And it's always striking to me whenever I speak to successful revenue marketers, it is always about the math equation, and they have simplified their world into a few numbers, and you have clearly done that. I have two follow-up questions for you. I definitely want to talk about your programs, campaigns for one-to-one or one-to-few, but before we get to that, Patty, I want to ask you about, you know, it's about volume, it's about the rate at which they convert, and it's about the deal size. And many marketers would argue that you have control over volume. You may have control over conversion because it really is about the quality. But how do you as a marketer have control over deal size?
Yeah, I think, you know, at Iron Mountain we do have, well, especially in named account marketing, you know, the best case scenario is solution selling where we can go after really big deals. And the other alternative is to really sell individual product lines. And we do both. And the range is dramatic, you know, into the $500,000 to literally, hundreds of dollars and thousands of dollars. But I think, so that's from a named account marketing perspective, you know, it's one of the luxuries and the risks that we have, that I have, you know, in doing the named account that I'm doing, that where I can choose to go after the bigger deal sizes. And, you know, we do have inside salespeople who sell direct, so they can, you know, I can enable them a little bit better to go after the smaller deal sizes. And so that's part of the mix, is where I have enablement programs that should help inside salespeople who are selling directly, smaller deals, do that better. But then I also have other programs that are designed to really identify big opportunities for the outside sales guys to go knock down.
Okay.
So that's where the mix really comes in to figure out, you know, where do I place my dollars and my resources.
So, Patty, let me ask you this. Did you, I mean, when you were putting together your three math metrics, volume, conversion, and deal size, were you talking to the VP of sales about this as well? I mean, was he or she kind of part of this conversation, especially around the deal size?
Absolutely. And the deal size also was, you know, because marketing is only, you know, contributing a certain percentage of revenue. I mean, we're not going to source 100% of sales revenue. So, you know, sales looks to marketing to say, oh, you know, you got to help me with, given the money you have, with, you know, let's say 25% of our revenue. So it's really a luxury that marketing has to say, all right, if me in marketing is going to help sales with 25% of the revenue, like, where can marketing really add the most value? And that's where you can have that conversation with the salesperson to say, do you really want me to help you identify the small deals, or let me help you identify the big deals? And so that's where that conversation is. And yeah, the sales VP and I had that conversation about the strategy and, you know, how we were going to approach it and, you know, where
that's
marketing
excellent.
Could really contribute.
Okay, excellent. All right. My second question, and then we'll get to the one-to-one or one-to-few, is, It's really around attribution. So if you take a look at your equation of volume, conversion, and deal size, and, of course, when the deal closes, let's say it's a $5,000 deal, and then you would say, you know, marketing, you know, hit their number, you know, $5,000, right? But what about if there's a second deal or a third deal in that account? Do you get any revenue credit or attribution for additional deals within that account?
Yeah, so it's a really tricky thing, and it's something that we're wrestling, or I'm personally wrestling with at Iron Mountain, specifically as it relates to named accounts, because, you know, we're going after existing customers for new opportunities. So what we're trying to do is specifically to, you know, take credit for places where marketing has helped identify a new opportunity. So let's say if we're doing cross-sell, so we've, you know, tapped into a new business unit and we've found, you know, a different opportunity to cross-sell one of our other products. So that's best case scenario. But then there's also, let's say for upsell, in, you know, where we're trying to sell more of the same to our existing customers, that's also a place where marketing can help find additional, you know, for Iron Mountain, it's finding more box, tape, or shred to sell into existing companies. And that's something which would be contribution as well. You know, we found another subsidiary who also needs our services, and then that's just yet a new opportunity, sort of.
Okay, and so all that counts for marketing as long as you can track it.
Yeah, and it's far from a perfect science now, but it's something,
right,
you know, we're really keenly aware of and trying to figure out, and especially for named account, because it is a little, it's not, you know, all net new opportunities. It's new opportunities.
Absolutely.
Within existing accounts.
Absolutely, and for a lot of companies, you know, it's the 80-20 rule. 80% of their business comes from, you know, 20% of those accounts, and so being able to, you know, to work with those accounts and find cross-sell and upsell opportunities, I mean, that's just a great place for marketing to be spending their time. I completely agree with that. So, Patty, one of the things that I've seen over the last few years, again, in this world of marketing automation and revenue marketing, is this focus on volume, and then there's been a little bit of a focus on quality. But I would say that day in and day out, overall, marketers are still vastly focused on the quantity of activities, the quantity of events, the quantity of leads, those types of things. So I'm fascinated with this concept that you have around one-to-one or one-to-few marketing. So you want to tell our audience a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'd love to. I would say, you know, what I'm working on is not, we're not yet at the point to one-to-one. And I think it would be hard to make, well, it would be interesting if I could make a case for, like, why, or if we had enough resources to do one-to-one marketing and make that pay off. So the named account marketing that we're doing is really one-to-few. And what I recognize, you know, in working the math is to say, like, the volume of the leads, when I do certain programs that drive high volume, the quality of those, they don't convert so well. But there's other programs that I can do which, granted, don't have as high volume, but the conversion is much higher. So I try to do that mix. So an example would be just in the past 6 months in working with the named accounts, we've had great success in with it's telemarketing. I call it teleopportunities, where we can really enable a telemarketing professional to go in and find big opportunities, whether they're trigger-based or just through conversations they have with many people within an organization. And, you know, you'd be amazed at the nice, beefy, high-value opportunities that we can find through that. So those opportunities, you know, those leads, they're pretty expensive, but they convert really well, and the average order size is typically much higher than some of the high-volume programs that I might run.
What are some of the things that you've done, not with telemarketing, but maybe more, you know, with using marketing automation, you know, demand generation, that way that's had some high conversions for you?
Yeah, so that's one. I also put, you know, some of the events that we do, those convert pretty high. And the way I set my, you know, I describe it as volume programs, quality programs, and high value programs. And in the volume, you know, it's more awareness programs, and nurture is, you know, my shining star in that set of programs. You know, the telemarketing is my shining star right now in my quality. And for the value-based things, you know, we're really wrestling with using assessments and benchmarks. And this is, you know, I'm trying to tee up additional programs. Like, I need certain programs in each one of those buckets that I can count on, that I can dial up or dial down. And then I'm constantly just trying to optimize additional programs in those buckets so that I can, you know, I just have a bigger mix to work with.
Okay. So, I'm just fascinated by, again, revenue marketing, two enterprise accounts, a lot of these, you know, Fortune 1000 that, you know, our listeners would absolutely, you know, recognize if we talked about the kinds of companies that you called on. So in order to do these kinds of programs, how large a team do you have, Patty? It sounds like you have tons of people.
No, we have a pretty small team. We have this, including myself, this team of four, and we support about 75 sales executives.
And kind of how do your roles break down across the team? I mean, that's a small team for the kind of impact that you guys are having. That's a very efficient team, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, it's you know, I try to set it up as a matrix, so where we're not necessarily aligned to a particular sales territory, but we're really aligned to, you know, I call them service line initiatives, which need strategy and execution against. And then I also have the team aligned to an aspect of the program mix. So, for example, I would assign one of the leaders on my team, you know, to really mastermind this volume set, to, you know, make that engine work. Whereas I have assigned somebody else to, on the other extreme, you know, help me figure out, like, how we can get closer to one-to-one and make these one-to-one programs hum. And then also somebody assigned to the middle mix, like, all right, you're responsible to make these high-converting programs, you know, hit the number that we're looking for. And then in addition to that, then there's a matrix also where they're assigned to certain service line initiatives so that they can be the liaison with service line owners as well.
I love that. That structure makes so much sense, Patty, given that, you know, you've got the metrics, you've got programs that you manage like a portfolio. I truly love that concept. Need to write a white paper on that. I think that'd be a great, great white paper, and I think so many people will find a great deal of value in it. So that's a little bit about the team that kind of supports this. It's a little bit around your portfolio, your philosophy, and your approach toward that portfolio. It's a little bit around the notion of one to few, which I think makes a lot of marketers uncomfortable, but I think you're right. At a certain level sale, especially at the enterprise sale, you know, having the volume more around awareness and nurture, and then really focus on those high value add relationships that you can do, you know, later, you know, for a different kind of mix, makes a whole lot of sense. I've also heard you use a term that kind of fits into this model, and it's really two things. Number one, it's the value of thought leadership to your world. And number two, it's something that you called creating a herd of leaders. So why don't you tell us a little bit more around the role of thought leadership?
Yeah, I'm insanely passionate about thought leadership. And I think, you know, doing demand generation for as many years as I have, you know, things like the list that we're targeting and the message that we're saying is hypercritical, never mind the creative. Like, those things have to work. And being in demand for so long, you know, I'm constantly looking for the compelling, you know, jaw-dropping points of view that I can feature in my demand campaigns. So, you know, while I desperately want that, and, you know, there's not always a continual flow of these compelling points of view coming my way that I can feature in demand generation, you know, I've found myself often trying to create that or help the organization, you know, consistently create this, you know, I call it a content engine, that I could consistently get this compelling points of view that I can feature my demand generation, which I know will make my programs that much more successful. So that's how I, you know, landed on this. I had, it's like this a thought leadership initiative where, you know, if the thought leadership wasn't coming to me, I would enable the thought leadership within the company. And, you know, kind of doing that through surveys and assessments to kind of feed back to the organization, you know, what the market was saying, and to you know, help them become thought leaders in our own company and really broaden the group that we had. So it's this whole notion of using data-driven analysis to create, you know, I call it like a content catalyst, because then, you know, once you have that data, it has this ripple effect on what types of content you can create, you know, who the thought leaders are behind that content, and it just has this, you know, tremendous ripple effect. And, you know, so that's kind of the way to create these herds of thought leaders.
So, Patty, do you feel like having an enterprise focus, you know, generating market qualified leads at an enterprise level, do you feel like the role of thought leadership and thought leadership in the context of being a content catalyst is more important than if you were, you know, selling to small companies or more transactional types of relationships?
I guess I would have to say yes for, you know, in an enterprise sell, you know, you've got to bring value to the organizations. Like, what are our unique ways of doing things? You know, what are things that are best practices that they haven't thought of? And, you know, I think that's the responsibility we have when we, you know, service our customers, that we have a relationship with them. We have to keep bringing to the table best practices and different points of views and ways to do things differently. So, yeah, I think it's more critical in enterprise selling or solution selling versus, you know, direct product or service line selling.
Absolutely. And don't you also find, Patty, that, you know, when you're doing that enterprise sale, you know, having that one cohesive message at the top, you know, rather than having, oh, buy me, oh, buy me, oh, no, buy me, you really got to have that top-level message at the top to engage with these larger organizations. Haven't you found that to be true?
It's true, and it's just so much more powerful when all the content pieces are connected and it's really integrated, because it just becomes, you know, 1,000 times more powerful. And, you know, when it all emanates from the center or ties back to the center, it's just got so much more weight to it.
Yeah,
So the whole integrated content is pretty key.
Yeah. And do you, when you take a look at your content, Patty, so for example, you've got programs that we talked about which were kind of more in the awareness bucket. How do you determine what kind of content based on which program portfolio that you're running?
Yeah. So even like I said, when I first, you know, went down the marketing automation path, it was really driven by the desire to do a nurture newsletter and have dynamic content fed, you know, specifically to different audiences where it became relevant. So the content need, you know, even in the volume bucket and what we do from a nurture perspective is, you know, critical. But then also on the other extreme, you know, where, you know, the value-based programs and what we're trying to do around assessments and benchmarks and surveys, you know, in getting that information from our customers and then feeding back to them, you know, the insight that we have is, you know, really critical. And that needs to be featured in programs at both extremes.
So, you know, there's also a lot of conversation right now in content around, you know, content types. You know, do I give somebody a white paper? Do I give somebody a game to play? Do I give somebody a podcast? Do I give somebody a data sheet? What has been, you know, as you take a look at these enterprise accounts, what kind of content types have you seen work best, Patty?
I don't think I can really say, and I have a little different perspective on the content types, because, you know, there's a lot of talk about it, there's a lot of, you know, desire to create, you know, the videos, the white papers, the webcasts, the blogs, you know. But I still am a firm believer that if all those different types emanate from a core message or a core point of view, then for me it's ultra easy to create those many, many, many different types. But it's like as long as it ties back to a big integrated message with unique points of view that differentiate the company, then it makes it easier to develop all those different content types. And I think the challenge that I have is, like, I could say right now the content type is working. I would love to say that it's, you know, the enterprise audience is, you know, tweeting and, you know, we can run around and do that, which, you know, they're obviously not. But for me, it's about the content. If I could feed to our sales guys, you know, really compelling points of view that gave them a reason to pick up the phone and call their contacts, that got them to return their call, you know, I did my job, and that could have been, you know, in a phone call, it could have been in an email, or it could have been in a tweet. But it's like, it's what is the compelling point of view that for me is key, not the type.
I love where you're going with this. And so let me ask you a few more questions with this, because I think this is a gem in this conversation that we're having today for any revenue marketer who is responsible at the enterprise level, in that everything that you do doesn't have to be this gigantic, enormous, you know, type of campaign. So, Patty, what you're talking about is, now, you've got an enterprise salesperson. They're responsible for a territory, or they may have 10 named accounts, right? And if you could give them a compelling point of view that makes whoever they should be interacting with say, I never thought about that before, and potentially get them to want to enter into a conversation with that salesperson, there's all kinds of ways that you can be pushing out that point of view, all kinds of ways that you can be enabling sales to be firing off these points of view. So to your point, you mentioned, you know, it could be, you know, leave a phone message. Here's a point of view, third-party research. Send them an email. Send them a tweet. Put something on your LinkedIn profile. So is that kind of the direction that you're talking about?
It's exactly it. It's, you know, it doesn't, and I think the challenge we have is, like, you know, the temptation to run off and do very extensive. You know, let's say I have that dream world compelling point of view. You know, I could run off and create a very expensive, you know, professionally produced video. But I'm not convinced that's what it really requires. And I think the problem that I've seen is that we do, as marketers, spend a lot of energy creating, you know, the ultimate video, the ultimate webcast, you know, the ultimate brochure, the ultimate email. But, you know, if all those things aren't, you know, driven by compelling points of view and tied together that feed, you know, a chain reaction and they're linked together, then that, I think that's the problem, is because we're spending a lot of money on disparate, you know, content types and focusing on the type or the media that we're using instead of the message itself.
I think that's absolutely right. And not just the message, but the impact and how to get that message out. So, for example, a campaign and email is not the be-all, end-all. You know, how can you enable sales to take pieces of that point of view and pieces of that campaign and make it relevant to the feeders on the street who are closest or potentially closest to a prospect or a client? I mean, there's so many different ways that you can do this, and it's really kind of like, you know, imagine having a library in front of you with little tiny, tiny, tiny books, and you can take out any piece that you need and put it together in any combination that you need for any channel that you need, whether it's a tweet or LinkedIn or whether it's email or whether it's a webcast or whether it's a live event, but that it all creates this cohesive message and really enables that salesperson to be successful.
That's exactly it, and it's all integrated, and, you know, all the pieces have the same message and they all link from one to the other. It's like, here was a little email that links to the longer white paper that has a webcast behind it, that has a video blog from a customer with a testimonial from an analyst. you know, if you get all those things to link together, it's insanely powerful.
So it sounds to me, Patty, like you have your marketing team has a close working relationship with the sales organization. Is this true?
Yeah, we do at Iron Mountain, and it's an amazing thing. And it's definitely developed, I would say, in the past few years, it's come a long, long ways. And it's it's pretty solid right now.
Well, so you have to share with everybody what your tricks were, what the tips are. You know, how did you get that alignment in place?
I definitely would not take the credit for that. I think it's more in, you know, we've had some very strong marketing leadership with strong sales leadership, and recent changes too, I think, you know, made those connections, you know, they relied on each other, you know, being new to the organization, and it was a lot of hard work, but I definitely wouldn't be the one to take that credit. I've definitely benefited from it since then, and I've seen it, you know, come a long, long ways, and it is pretty powerful.
And where do you think you'd be if you didn't have that alignment?
Yeah, I describe it as, especially from a named account perspective, you know, I can, in marketing, more so like if I was marketing to SMB or mid-market, when I market to enterprise-sized companies, I can do more harm. You know, there's pretty risk that I could, pretty big risk that I could do more harm than good. So, like, we have to be in coordination. Like, you know, if sales is the right hand, you know, marketing is the left hand, and we have to know what each other's doing. You know, they're really the strong muscle, and, you know, the left hand is the creative, marketing is more of the finessing, but they've got to be in sync. And, you know, I have to be careful when I market into an organization where, you know, there could be a customer service issue, or they could be negotiating a new contract. You know, when I fly in with a marketing message, it's the sales guys have to be in tune with it, or I have
so
to be in tune more so with their initiatives.
So how do you make sure that that doesn't happen with named account programs?
Yeah, I think we were worried about it more at the beginning than we needed to be, and, you know, we ran into a few challenges. But for the most part, you know, we just stay in communication about which programs we're running, and they opt in and opt out for their accounts for the most part. And, you know, we work it that way. And there's tons of room for improvement. But
yeah, I
so
love that.
So,
let's say, for example, you have a major campaign coming up, maybe on, I don't know, shredding. And I know you guys wouldn't do this, but the campaign would offer some kind of discount for new clients to shredding, kind of like the, you know, the cell phone model. But your salesperson would be able to see that and say, oh, I'm going to opt these five accounts out of that because I'm in negotiations with them right now and I don't want them to see any additional offers right now. It would be something like that.
It's true. It's like that the pricing thing, you're right, we would never do, and because that would wreak havoc. But and what I've tried to do in the way that I run the marketing programs is I try to avoid doing these one-off initiatives that require this extensive back and forth. And what I'm trying to do is run ongoing programs that the sales people become, you know, comfortable with and familiar with, and they know that they're running in the background. And when I do have very specific initiatives, you know, that's when I would do the heavy-handed, manual, time-intensive, you know, handoff to say, are you opting in, are you opting out? But I try to make sure that I have plenty of programs running in the background that everybody's aware of that, you know, keeps my engine running, and try to limit these one-off programs or, you know, let's say service line initiatives to as few as possible.
Okay.
So that, I mean, that it would slow us down too much.
And I think that makes perfect sense. I mean, and great. So I want to come back to another expression that we had talked about earlier. And clearly, working with enterprise accounts, you know, your ability to have thought leadership, to have that high-level messaging, to be in constant sync and alignment with your enterprise reps, that your marketing team is supporting, all those things are incredibly important. At the same time, you need to also be in alignment with your executives. And those executives need to be in line with the thought leadership. So I do want to come back to the notion of creating a herd of leaders. And I know that you're just now kind of getting this division up and running, but I know, Patty, that in a prior division at Iron Mountain, you had a great success in creating what you call that herd of leaders. Maybe you could describe that in more detail, because I think this is can make a significant impact on revenue for marketing. So share that with us.
Yeah, it's a system that I put in place
specifically to help make my demand programs more successful. And again, like I described before, knowing that the compelling points of view were critical to those. So I call them, authorities within the organization. And the science went like this. We would do market surveys to kind of test out our points of view. And the surveys were really validating those points of view and also giving us great data on, the receptiveness to that. So I would do these literally on a quarterly basis to help build the data around the points of view, to validate the points of view. And from there, what we would do is, once we landed on our compelling points of view, we would validate that within the organization. And we would also validate it with our customers. So ideally, I would get a case study. I would then validate it with an analyst and would have them comment on it. And we would do a Q&A article with an analyst. Then I would, test out the point of view with one of our partners, and they would, weigh in on it as well. And so this just created a ton of content around a specific point of view. And what we would do is I would feature subject matter experts in the organizations that owned that particular service line or that unique point of view. And we would write articles about them. We would do videos. I call them little thinklets. It was a video thinklet. And it started out, it's like that compelling point of view, that here's just a little something to think about. And we would feature, just a snapshot of that point of view and feature some of the data that would then lead to the webcast, that would lead to the white paper, that could lead to the case study, that would lead to the thought leader at Iron Mountain that they could talk to, that would lead to, the white paper, that would lead to the report that had all the data that was supporting it. And that's where I really got the integration. And it's, in doing that for many years that I really was able to get that engine really going. And that's the way that I knew that I could, quarter after quarter refresh my content and tie all my programs together and the content together to, whatever that point of view was. It was like point of view de quarter.
That's amazing. I know you told me that story before, and what a great way to syndicate content, and what an easy way for you to get content. Just have a point of view and go out and ask people whose opinions actually matter and whose opinions other people would love to be able to hear. I just love that story. So when you guys did these little thinklet videos, these little point of views, how long were they?
Yeah, this was years ago, and we did a few of them, but they were, intentionally less than 2 minutes.
I love it. I absolutely love that. And so you could take that same concept and do video blogs, right, from these subject matter experts.
Exactly, and I think just where I have a giant pause is like where we all want to like jump in and do the video, like jump in and create the blog and jump in and, send the tweet. It's like...
Mm-hmm.
I'm good with that as long as it's all mapping together.
Right, right. And that all the parts create something greater than the sum of the parts. Some of the parts are greater than the whole. That's it. That's the thing I was trying to think of.
Yeah.
It's hard.
It's hard, but,
if you're in an organization where thought leadership counts for something, and it's certainly a point, and being able to present those points of view, especially working in larger enterprises, I think many times when an enterprise is looking at their list of vendors, you know, you've got, you know, the five or six that are vendors, and then you've got one that really is a trusted advisor. It's this kind of relationship that creates that trusted advisor status, and that's how you optimize our relationship with a major account. So absolutely, absolutely love that story around creating a herd of leaders. Absolutely love that. So Patty, you've been doing this since 2005, and you've done it for a couple of divisions at Iron Mountain. What have been really some of the biggest challenges that you've had along the way? And I'm sure there have been many. And how have you overcome them?
For me, I think it's two things. One is integration and focus. So I, in every day in managing, my own time, it's staying focused. And I also encourage my team to stay focused. I try to make sure the entire, I encourage the entire group. It's like stay focused on the task at hand and play our role. Because the temptation to be distracted by, it's like sales, what's the shiny new object that they want to sell versus, what's the meat and potatoes of the business that we rely on. So focus is one thing, and it's really, somebody described it to me as, it's the need to focus and to have the courage to really deselect. So that's one thing.
Before you move to integration, we have to stay on this. What did you say again? The courage to focus and the wisdom to deselect?
No, it's the need. It's understanding the need to focus, and then having the courage to deselect.
And you got to say more about that.
Yeah, I worked with this girl, Jackie Sue, and she said that to me years ago, and it's never left the top of my mind. And it's just, it's like having your plan, having confidence in the plan and staying focused on it and making sure that you don't get distracted. But it's hard to say no. This is something I've personally, been challenged with. People on my team are challenged with it. I see executives challenged with it. And it's hard to say no, but...
But Patty, don't you think that having a portfolio, can you still hear me, Patty?
Yep.
Okay, just make sure I had not just turned my button off. So, but I also think because of your program portfolio that you manage, you're telling sales, I'm going to deliver X percent of the revenue, whether that's 10, 15, 20, 50%, whatever that is. We all agree this is the mission for marketing, and we're driven to deliver a revenue number. Don't you think that, and then being able to report on that accountability, don't you think that helps you say no more often?
You would think it does, but I think a lot about that. It's like, what percentage of revenue are we really affecting? And, when I talk to a sales guy, like, I stop and I say, I only deserve 25% of his time. He's on his own for 75% of his revenue. Like, that's all I'm contributing. So I have to be really – I have to make sure what I do is of tremendous value. So – and I do that – this is what I'm trying to create with the team that I have now. It's like when enterprise marketing calls our sales guys, we better have something, a big opportunity for them. Like, we can't bother them with small opportunities. Like, we have to build that credibility and make a difference. And in doing that, I have to say, where am I going to spend my time to make sure when I have to call the sales guy that it's of tremendous value to him and it's worth his effort to pick up that phone and talk to me?
Absolutely. And I can see that. But, okay, So I think that's a good description of focus. And, again, I love this, the need to focus and the courage to deselect. And I love that. So focus was one of the challenges that you had to overcome, and the other was integration. So let's talk about that for a few minutes.
Yeah, and it's all, you know, economies of scale and integrating, like, for example, even just within my own team, integrating the work that we do, integrating our efforts, and to make sure that it's the same thing with the content, you know, integrating the content so that none of the programs are just one-off standing on their own. Nobody on the team is by themselves, you know, trying to, on an island, trying to find revenue. You know, we're all in this together. And that there's a chain reaction on the different things that we do, and they're all feeding one another or, you know, supporting the good of the whole. So I think integrating, and even with the money that we're doing, like I might spend money on building a database for one particular service line, but if I can identify funds that I plan to spend in database building for another service line, like how can I now go to a vendor with that bigger spend and get bigger leverage? So it's integrating everything. It's integrating the money, it's integrating the people, integrating the programs, integrating the content, integrating the efforts, and it's both those. Focus and integration are a constant battle, and that's a constant challenge, but you know, I love it.
And then do you also integrate with other parts of the marketing organization? Because I believe you have a structure where you have product marketing, corporate marketing, and so I would imagine that would be an integration that would be have to be effective as well.
It's true. And so it's, you know, integrating with the other, let's say the mid-market demand generation group or the SMB group, you know, integrating with product marketing, integrating with sales, you know, integrating with the web team. It goes on and on.
So,
and, you know, making sure all those efforts are
so
aligned.
When you think about doing that level of integration, what do you think is absolutely critical to getting the right level of integration across everything that you've just spoken about?
Metrics. The metrics drive the behavior. Yeah, the goals that you set for the group. It drives behavior. And it can drive good behavior and bad behavior, so it's really important. It's like, you know, setting goals for salespeople. They'll sell the shiny object unless you set goals against the meat and potato.
That's exactly right, and I agree with you.
It's the same for marketing. I'll market the shiny object, but I got to market the meat and potatoes too.
Okay. You know, I always do this, Patty. I get so darn interested in these conversations. We have about 8 minutes left, and I've got like 20 more questions I'd like to ask you. But what I really kind of want to wind up with is, I mean, you've shared a lot with us. You shared us your program portfolio approach, which I think is brilliant. And again, I always find the best revenue marketers are so simple in their approach. You're like, well, you know, it's kind of like I could have had a V8. Well, why aren't I doing it like that, right? I love the way you put everything into a math equation. I love the way that you manage different facets of the portfolio. I love the way that you've been able to create that fabulous integration with sales. And also the fact that you have a metric-driven marketing organization so that it allows them to stay focused. But most importantly, the fact that you realize is this is not about technology. It's about the message. And that integration piece that you're talking about, when you say integration, people will instantly think about, you know, is the technology, is the marketing automation tied to the CRM, and blah, blah, blah. It's just not the most important thing. It's foundational, and it must be there. But it's the integration of the message and how you're communicating with your prospects and your clients to bring them along a buy cycle so eventually, you know, they'll want to be involved in the conversation with you. And I think that obsessing around that kind of integration is one of the things that makes you the revenue marketer that you are. And I always talk about obsessing over the online digital relationship, and that's in essence what you've been doing. So we have a few minutes, and you talked about your challenges, but let me ask you this, Patty. If you were talking to a brand new marketer, someone who is just beginning this journey, this place that you started at in 2005, what are the three pieces of advice you would give them?
Oh, if I knew then what I know now. Yeah, I'm happy to help somebody avoid the pain and suffering I've been through. I would say most importantly is to attach yourself to revenue. Know exactly what your direct line is to revenue and benchmark where you are now and be able to demonstrate how you can improve it. And So that's, I think that's it. It's like attaching yourself to revenue. Know how you affect it and, you know, and change it. Make sure and report against it. And I, for me, you know, if I had to break it down, I thought about it is it's like three parts. It's like I would say do the math, like know your number, like how you're going to make the numbers work. Build a program portfolio that you can depend on and to really then monitor and optimize it. Like you would an investment portfolio. Like know what numbers you want to get to. Like where do you want to retire in decades from now? What money do you need, you know, next month? And make sure that you have the right investments in place or the portfolio designed to accomplish those goals. And then monitor it. Make sure it's continually optimized.
I love that, and I think that's fabulous advice for anyone starting. It's simple, but if you're going to be a revenue marketer, this is what it means. If you think that your life can continue doing a whole bunch of activities and not integrating and not getting to revenue, you may not have your job for very long because that's just not the way the world is working today. So, Patty, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show today. Two things. I think you really do need to write a white paper on this, but the least you can do is do a guest blog for me, and I'd love to post it on our Revenue Marketer blog because I really love this portfolio approach that you have to building and implementing programs. So thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.